Good afternoon, and welcome to Open Air, KALW's weekly radio magazine of all things culturally considered. Here on KALW, I'm David Latulipe. This week, a panoply of guests that encompasses the world of theater, song and dance show business, and the concert stage. Earlier this week, I spoke by phone with Broadway legend Tommy Tune, who is appearing Sunday at the Venetian Room. You'll hear that conversation a little later in the hour. Local theater royalty Barbara Oliver and I chatted about her role over the years with the Aurora Theater. She's currently directing four short plays of Thornton Wilder there called Wilder Days. That conversation ahead here on KLW. Also on the theater front, Austin Forbord, director and producer of the documentary Stage Left, A Story of Theater in San Francisco, will be on this radio stage to talk about that film, which premieres on KQED television this Sunday at 10 p.m. There's a whole lot of things going on the area's concert stages, including a couple of which for which I'll offer some tickets later in the hour, including concerts by the Bay Area Rainbow Symphony on Saturday, the Oakland East Bay Symphony tomorrow, and the Philharmonia Baroque has concerts featuring pianist Emmanuel Ax. The Philharmonia Orchestra is in town with Esa-Pekka Salonen with a run at the Zellerbach Hall. That's just a few things that are happening in this very vital Bay Area. And to begin today's broadcast, a conversation with Michael Morgan of our own Oakland East Bay Symphony, which also has concerts this weekend. Maestro Morgan, welcome back to KLW.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Now, appropriate for this week, your opening concert for the 2012-13 season is entitled Celebrating Democracy. Now, might that celebration have had a different energy level had things turned out differently on Tuesday?
Yeah, I would say my audience is a little one-sided on the what it was looking for on Tuesday. But we were prepared to celebrate democracy regardless.
Oh, good for you.
And I think everyone is ready to celebrate it just being over.
Oh, amen to that, brother. I certainly hear you there. Now, the concert that you've put together for this program is an interesting mix of composers. Some are more familiar than others. The symphonic dances of Bernstein's West Side Story will conclude the concert. I'm sure you've got some wonderful Lenny B. stories that you'll share with us before this hour's open.
Sure.
Great.
Okay.
Aaron Copland's wonderful clarinet concerto, which will be performed by your new principal clarinetist, Bill Kalinkos, and a couple of less familiar works, Augustus Hailstork's An American Fanfare, which was written in 1985, and then Ollie Wilson's Episodes for Orchestra, plus the world premiere of a work by composer Gordon Getty that actually had its genesis back when he was a student back in the early 60s called Homework Suite, but it's having its world premiere here with you. Fantastic program.
Yes, we have had a really fantastic relationship with Mr. Getty, and I thought it was about time we played one of his pieces on one of our programs. And we've done readings of his music. I've done a recording of a piece of his an arrangement of his up at Skywalker Ranch. He's a wonderful man and making just a tremendous contribution to music in so very many ways. And so this, really a thank you to play a piece of his on this program of All American. And plus he's a legend here in the Bay Area. So, and the pieces are, I think they're five movements. They're very short, maybe 1 minute a piece. They very much reminiscent to me of the Schumann Kinderszenen of miniatures for the Schumann is, of course, miniatures for piano, including the famous Traumerei. But same idea of short pieces, extremely charming music, and so looking forward to giving those a launch. I think they have been played before, but never in a public concert.
And newly arranged, or are they just coming out of his what do they call it, a truck? The box of music.
He's got a lot of music, and so I think this is just, I asked for something for this concert, and it occurred to him that this piece had never actually been performed in public, and so it would be nice to hear it live. So that's why we're doing that particular one.
Great, and perhaps maybe a recording project in the works down the road.
Wouldn't that be nice?
Now, a composer as a musician, I'm completely unfamiliar with Augustus Hailstork. Could you tell us a little bit about him?
one of the most fantastic composers alive today. The Hale Stork, I've done many of his pieces with various orchestras and choral works and vocal music from, I think, the last place. I think I first did this particular piece at the Alabama Symphony, I think 2 years ago they asked for it, on a concert that was on a Martin Luther King concert. And as far as I'm concerned, Hale Stork is really one of the deans amongst particularly African-American classical composers at the moment. But he's one of those composers that sort of sneaks up on you every time you do one of his pieces. Ollie Wilson's kind of the same way. Once you get into any one of his pieces, you just forget until you're in the middle of it how well crafted and the writing is. I mean, just what a talent!
Well, talk to us about Hale Stork's particular style of writing.
Hale Stork is very traditional, very tonal. This fanfare mixes elements of what you would think of as a typical fanfare, along with some slightly jazzier elements. It's only about a 3 to 5 minute piece. The thing that strikes me, and this is that I always find striking when I come across pieces like this, is the Copland Fanfare for the Common Man is a wonderful piece, but this is at that level, and up until Alabama asked me to do it, I had not heard it before. And I've done it several times since in different places just because it's such a fantastic fanfare. So that's really it. His music has a great deal of tradition in it, and has a lot of it has jazz and spiritual roots, but this is really the front section is really typical what you think of as a fanfare, and then the middle section is a little more, I'll just say, jazzy, for lack of a better descriptive.
Okay.
But very, very well crafted, very good, wonderful brass writing, brass and percussion.
Very nice, and very accessible, I'm sure, with that.
Oh, yes, absolutely.
And Ollie Wilson celebrating his 75th birthday this year. Talk to me about your association with Ollie.
I've known Ollie Wilson ever since I got here. Which is now getting on, 23 years or something I've been at Oakland Space Symphony, like that.
Wow, fantastic.
A long time. And, in fact, I think my sister knew Ollie Wilson before I did because she went to UC Berkeley and lived in International House there. And I think somehow through that she ran across Ollie Wilson even before I did. But, again, the music is very different from Hale Stork. Very different. Much more motivic, much more quote-unquote modern, if you will, but also with elements of bluesy elements, jazzy elements, in a completely different context. And again, just extremely well crafted the piece is. And so this piece, Episodes, which, as you might imagine, is episodic, even though it lies in three large sections of this one movement piece, but there are smaller episodes within, was written for the Detroit Symphony some years ago. And I don't know if this is the West Coast premiere. I kind of think it probably is.
Well, we can call it that. Why not?
Yes.
Let the fact checkers beware.
Yes. Not going to let fact checkers run my orchestra either. There you are.
Now, you've worked as assistant to or with, in many ways, Leonard Slatkin, George Schulte, Daniel Barenboim. But I'm intrigued by your association with Leonard Bernstein. You're doing the Leonard Bernstein Symphonic Suite from West Side Story to finish things out. Let's hear Lenny Bernstein's story.
Well, I first met him at Tanglewood in 1977, I think it was, that I was at.
Let's get that fact checker on that.
Yes, right. 1977, the summer of 77, I was at Tanglewood, and that's where I first met him. He coached me on the Beethoven Seventh was the first thing that ever, first time I ever encountered him, a very early morning reading at Tanglewood. You never forget where you met the man. And we did the first movement with the student orchestra, just doing a reading, and he was sitting over on the side, and he came up, and my most vivid memory of him is talking to the orchestra, and anyone who's ever been praised by Bernstein knows that when he praised something, he went all in. So he was going on just about how great he thought it had been. I was completely distracted by the fact that he had his right arm draped around me, and so I had a lit cigarette next to my ear. So the fact that he was talking about it was really barely registering because I was trying not to turn my head and get burned. But
it's funny you mentioned the burning cigarette. Someone told me an anecdote from Tanglewood as well that, you know, some young assistant was with Bernstein and he had his cigarettes about to drip off the dash, and immediately the assistant pulls out one of those small ashtray, pocket ashtrays, and he says, "This kid's going to go far."
No, that was the first time I ever met him, was during that summer, and he was, from then until now, just a great inspiration and a great teacher by example of both how one lets oneself go inside a piece of music, but also how important it is to pass on whatever you know to the next generation, because he was constantly doing that.
You mentioned the Beethoven 7th Symphony that you worked on with him. We're actually going to share at the end of this hour a recording that Lenny did with the Vienna Philharmonic of Beethoven's 5th, because the Bay Area Rainbow Symphony is doing Beethoven's 5th on Saturday. So we're going to play a little bit of Bernstein's interpretation of the 5th, the slow movement. But what an amazing inspiration. That relationship developed into...
Well, I worked with him first then. I worked with him a lot more, actually, between 86 and the end of his life, because I was at the Chicago Symphony as the assistant conductor, and also did a New York Philharmonic debut on a concert that he coached. He invited three of us to come and make our New York Philharmonic debuts they had him conduct the piece on the second half of the concert so that someone would come and see the concert. And then the three of us each conducted small pieces on the first half of the concert. We did that, I think, a couple times in Lincoln Center. That was in 1986, the concert, which is affectionately known by anyone who was around at that time as the concert of the three Michaels, because all three of us coincidentally had the first name Michael. It was me and then Michael Barrett, who is a Bernstein assistant forever and ever.
Sure, yeah.
And Michael Stern, who is now at Kansas City, mm-hmm. Running that orchestra.
Hmm.
So that was, and we basically spent a week with the New York Philharmonic as our laboratory orchestra. They had some services they needed to use up. And so that's how he didn't want to do a concert, but he said he would teach for the week.
Not a shabby group to be working with there.
Oh, they're wonderful. Yeah. Yes. Yes. Yeah.
And what else is happening with the rest of the Oakland East Bay Symphony season?
As usual, a quite wide variety of things. Our traditional holiday concert in December, Let Us Break Bread Together, with Interfaith Gospel Choir and the Mount Eden High School Chorus and the Piedmont Boys and Girls Choir and Kugelplex, which has become our resident klezmer band. And I'm sure I'm leaving someone out. that's coming up in the second weekend in December. In January, we have Angela Brown, the wonderful dramatic soprano, coming and doing Richard Daniel Poor's A Woman's Life, which is a song cycle written for her by Richard Daniel Poor on texts of Maya Angelou. And on that concert also the Symphonie Fantastique of Berlioz. Later on in the season, we do the series of concerts which in-house we call our virtual world tour, since we're not likely to go on a real one anytime soon. This year it's the Middle East, and we have Israeli music, we have Egyptian music, we have Arab Palestinian music, soloists from all of those places. I'm sharing it with an Israeli American conductor. That's quite the fiesta. That's our April concert.
And that virtual tour, you know, you save so much time and money. You know, no lines at the airport.
No, yeah, no TSA to
there
deal
you go.
With. Exactly. Yeah, we've done Persia, we've done Armenia, we've done China. Last year we did the Philippines. That's been a really interesting. Really interesting series. Season finale, I know, is the Bach Magnificat with the Pacific Boy Choir. Always wanted to do that piece specifically with Boy Choir and then men tenor and basses. So that should be that's quite fun. Emperor Concertos on that concert also, as well as a new work by our principal cellist Dan Ryder. I'm leaving something out.
Well, fact checkers everywhere can go to
OEBS.org. And you can see the
website.
You can see the entire season. Yeah, there's also a Fauré Requiem that's being conducted by Lynn Morrow, our chorus conductor, and the Brian Nisa, our assistant conductor, will be doing the sea interludes from Peter Grimes on that concert, and I'll be doing the Royal Fireworks music on that concert. So they get three conductors. We did this Carmina Burana last year where we used three conductors. We all rotated, and so we decided we'd all get together and do something.
Well, speaking of large works like that, a couple seasons ago, getting back to Bernstein, is you did the Bernstein Mass, and that was wonderful.
That's a few seasons ago now.
Yeah. What brought you to that work? Is it something that you discovered of his? Or
I had been
was
talking
brought
about,
to you?
I think I had been talking about doing the Bernstein Mass since I first got here. I came here the same year Bernstein died, but that piece was so tremendous and so huge. And of course, I have conductor friends who run much bigger orchestras than I do, who haven't ever gotten to do the Bernstein Mass just because of the expense of putting on the Bernstein Mass, because the forces are so huge. So we had to sort of ramp up to that. It took a few years to get there. And then, yes, we did a pretty highly acclaimed production of
that work had
a few years ago. Actually, that led to us doing a whole series of concerts we called American Masterworks, which we'll get back to. Next year we'll get back to. Well, not next year, because next year our season finale is actually a piece by Clark Zaprinovitz written on the a musical theater piece written on the era of the Black Panthers in Oakland. Not directly about the Black Panthers, but about that era and including elements of what was going on in Oakland at that time. So we try to have pieces written and do music that actually reflects the city that we live in or the place we live in. I think that's an important survival skill for orchestras to have these days, to actually reflect where they are, as opposed to trying to impress some unknown, world audience.
Sure. I mean, speaking of that, you said you were in your 23rd or so year with the Oakland East Bay Symphony. Mm-hmm. Michael Tilson Thomas, a number of years here at the San Francisco Symphony.
Because he's such a great match for the city. Exactly.
Kent Nagano, a long time spent with the Berklee Symphony, and mm-hmm. insisting on coming back to that. It's so wonderful that you, a world conductor that could probably conduct anywhere you so desired, you still call Oakland East Bay your home.
Well, they let me do these crazy things like the Bernstein Mass and put on a concert version of Follies and do all these things that I simply would not be allowed to do elsewhere. So I'm having a tremendous amount of fun, and as long as everyone's having fun, might as well keep going.
So you're drawn to the more theatrical elements. I read something recently in the SFCV website, San Francisco Classical Voice, that one of your highlights of your trip to New York was seeing the Book of Mormon.
I saw the Book of Mormon three times in the theater, and I never see anything. I rarely get to see things once, but I actually saw it three times in the theater. And, I do not live in New York, so some effort was needed to do that.
Well, it's going to be in town here.
I know, but I feel like I've now seen, actually, I would go see it again, but other people need to see it, so, I will let them.
Were you at Tanglewood at the time that Aaron Copland was hanging out the same time?
I was not. I met Copland only in passing at the very, very, very end of his professional life, so really very much in passing. I do find it interesting that I'm doing an All-American program this week where I'm now old enough to have actually met every composer on the program, which is really just startling.
No Vivaldi on the program.
No.
It's a good thing. Would be worried on that one.
Well, no, yeah, it had to be. The Friday after election was just we usually open on the first Friday in November, and I had a completely other program planned, back a year and a half, 2 years ago, and we were talking about what to do, and I realized that it was the Friday of election week, and I thought, it's the Oakland East Bay Symphony, we can only do an All-American program the week of a presidential election. I mean, it makes no sense whatsoever to do anything else.
Maybe you should have had a backup program of a Requiem.
We would have been fine regardless. The Republic would have been fine regardless. I've been telling everybody on both sides that we would have done just fine with either of these people. We, no matter what happens in the world, we have seen worse.
Or maybe you have Donna Summer come on and do an I Will Survive or something. Well, yeah, we'll make it. We really will.
Yes.
Off you go to rehearsal for this concert, which is tomorrow evening mm-hmm. at the
At the beautiful Paramount Theater.
At the Paramount Theater. We do have some tickets that we're going to offer to this concert. If you'd like to give me a call now here in the studio, 415-841-4134. We've got three pairs of tickets available, 841-4134. I was going to mention a little bit more about the Copland as we say goodbye. Your new principal clarinetist, Bill Kalinkos, is performing the Aaron Copland Concerto. As part of this program, we're actually going to go out with a historic recording of the man who commissioned the work,
yes.
Mr. Benny Goodman.
Another rock star. Mr. Kalinkos was a rock star clarinet player, so this is a Benny Goodman, a previous rock star.
All right, a tail end of Benny Goodman performing Aaron Copland's clarinet concerto under the baton of Aaron Copland from a very old LP that one of our engineers here in KLW News, Seth Samuel, was kind enough to rip to a CD. So it's a historic recording, which you can hear live tomorrow evening at the Paramount Theater. Tickets at oebs.org, or a few lucky folks that are on the phone now. We have all the lines tied up, so I'm afraid folks that are, if you hear the phone ringing, I'll be with you in just a moment while we listen to some Copland and I say goodbye to Maestro Morgan.
Thank you.
Thanks for being with us.
Of course. Thank you.
the great Benny Goodman, with obviously a little tribute to him at the end with that flourish. Benny Goodman, the man who commissioned the the Clarinet Concerto of Aaron Copland. It's a work that you can hear tomorrow evening with the Oakland East Bay Symphony under the baton of Michael Morgan, my guest here on Open Air. The concert's called Opening Night, Celebrating Democracy, with music by Aaron Copland, Gordon Getty with a world premiere, Adolphus Hale Stork, and Ollie Wilson, as well as Leonard Bernstein's Symphonic Suite from West Side Story, rounding out that concert at the Paramount Theater. Information and tickets at oebs.org. I'm David LaTulipe, and you are tuned to KALW and listening to Open Air. Still to come this hour, a conversation with Barbara Oliver, Grand Dame of the theater, especially in the East Bay in the Aurora Theater, a conversation with her earlier this week. Tommy Toon, who is in town on Sunday for a performance at the Venetian Room. And next, a conversation with Austin Forbort, who joins me here in studio. Austin, good afternoon and welcome.
Thanks so much for having me.
Sure. Austin Forbort, video artist, filmmaker, award-winning choreographer. Your film, Stage Left, is a documentary about the theater scene early on here in San Francisco, which I had no idea was so historic and vibrant.
You know, I think that's sort of a typical thing. I made a film called Artists in Exile about 12 years ago about dance. And similarly with that film, I had no knowledge of what had been going on in this town and really had no context for the art I was making. And I think that this film hopefully will serve that same purpose for the theater community.
Mm-hmm. What was the most interesting thing you discovered in the making of this film about the world of theater here in San Francisco?
Well, continuing on that theme, just that San Francisco really was at the forefront of particularly experimental theater in the 70s and 80s, that the theater making that was going on here was outpacing New York, outpacing London in terms of how it was pushing boundaries across the board.
Mm-hmm. And how did that happen? I mean, why did people come out to San Francisco to make this happen? Was theater too rigid on the East Coast, or was it always a hotbed of experimentation here in the West Coast?
Well, you know, I think San Francisco is just that place. It's a place that people come to explore. You know, we're at the edge of the continent. We're really at the most progressive end of American thought, I'd like to think. You know, I think that the dialogue that happens in San Francisco is the one that pushes the dialogue forward across the country. And necessarily, I think that the artists that come here and make work have that attitude, and therefore that you know shows up in what they do.
Watching the documentary, it occurred to me that it seemed to be more making art and making theater for theater's sake rather than what they would hope for, a commercial success or to go to Broadway, where that seems to be the focus of the East Coast mindset. For the most part.
Yeah, and for better or for worse, I think that, you know, what that means in San Francisco is that sometimes the level of supposed professionalism isn't what one might hope to see in the theater. But I think on the other hand, what you get from that is you get, you know, that real sort of experimentality, that real carefree attitude, that real attitude that I'm going to, you know, plow through no matter what anyone has to say about what I'm doing. And I think it's in that attitude that, you know, that the boundaries are pushed and boundaries are broken.
And you interviewed how many people to make this happen? It must have been lots of you must have had to leave out.
That's true. We did 67 interviews, and they were all biographical in nature, really exhaustive, you know, at least an hour, hour and a half, 2 hours in some cases. And I think that the broadcast version, we ended up with about 45, I think the broadcast is a little under 45, and the festival version was just under 50.
Some of those folks include Peter Coyote, Bill Irwin, Oscar Eustace of the Public Theater, Tony Tacconi from the Berkeley Rep as well. Some really interesting folks in the early days of theater.
Yeah, we were really thrilled.
They're still going strong.
Well, absolutely. And I think that, you know, that list that you mentioned speaks to the influence that San Francisco has had on the American theater. If you look at Oscar Eustace, you know, at the Public, probably the most important nonprofit theater in the country. Tony Tacconi, obviously at Berkeley Rep, you know, continuing to output just incredible work. And really both of those men at the Eureka Theater developed the chops that they have and bring their political ethos, their social consciousness to the work that they do now.
And speaking of the Eureka Theater, shortly we'll have a conversation with Barbara Oliver, who's involved with the Aurora Theater for many, many years and is still going strong in her 80s. It's pretty amazing.
That's a great theater. I love the Aurora.
This film, the documentary, was winner of the Best California Film at the 2011 California Film Awards, among other festival awards and accolades. And it's really bringing such a rich theatrical tradition to the small screen. It's nice to see you'll have a much bigger exposure for people who may not have been aware of the extent to which this Bay Area was so is still thriving.
Well, I'm so thankful to KQED for pushing the broadcast and bringing the film forward and really supporting the whole process of really getting it out there and publicizing the broadcast. It's really exciting that it's going to reach a wide audience.
Sure, that will be on KQED television on this coming Sunday, November 11th at 10 p.m. And I'm sure it'll be in rotation in other stations, other PBS outlets throughout the country. Check your local listings, as they say, if you're listening online somewhere. And is there a website we can learn more about the film?
There is. It's stageleft-movie.com. And there's going to be a whole bunch of webisodes that we're going to place up there in the next several days. There's a whole bunch of information up there already. And perhaps most importantly, there is a timeline that we have that's accessible at the website for people to upload their own stories, their own photographs, their own videos. We really hope that this film is the beginning of people telling their stories about Bay Area theater.
Sunday, November 11th at 10 p.m. on KQED television. Take a look. Yeah, you're also working on an NEA-funded documentary about the vocal group Kitka for the 30th anniversary. I'm really looking forward to that. Tell us a little bit. Can you give us a little sneak preview of what that's going to be about?
Well, we're just getting going on that project. It's their 35th anniversary next year. And really, by coincidence, I had used a piece of their music in a film that I continue to work on about Sarajevo and Bosnia. They're known for doing extraordinary vocal music from the Balkans, as well as other places. And I'm just really excited that we're going to dig into their archives and try to tell their story.
I think a couple of those folks are on my calendar for being on Open Air in the next couple of weeks. So we'll hear them and we'll look forward to the film when it comes out. I'm sure we'll have you back for that.
Oh, I hope so.
Austin Forbord, thanks for taking a little time today on Open Air.
My pleasure. Thanks so much for having me.
Tune in once again to KQED, cross-pollination here with public radio, public television, Sunday, November 11th at 10 p.m. for Stage Left, a story of theater in San Francisco. I'm pleased and honored to welcome to Open Air Bay Area Theater Grand Dame and founding artistic director of the Aurora Theater, Barbara Oliver. Barbara, welcome back to KALW.
Thank you so much. I'm delighted to be here.
Well, I chose the term Grand Dame quite intentionally out of respect for the true breadth of works you've done, not only at the Aurora but elsewhere, directing classics of Ibsen and George Bernard Shaw, but championing new playwrights as well. You're the recipient of all sorts of awards, some Bay Area Theater Critics Circle Awards, including the Drama Log Awards. And you've appeared on stage as well in Aurora Theater Company productions of such classics as The Chairs and The Gin Game, wonderful works. So thank you for all of your wonderful work.
Oh, thank you. Lovely.
Now, you've stepped down a few years ago to slow down a little bit. I would hope to enjoy your golden years. You are, what they say, a lady of a certain age, shall we say?
Yes, indeed.
So these golden years, but you're back now to direct, among others, your son for a production of Wilder Times.
Right.
Four short plays of Thornton Wilder.
Right.
That I understand have never been performed together.
I don't think they ever have. As far as we know, they never have been done together before.
Now, Thornton Wilder, of course, known best for Our Town.
Right.
Also an accomplished master of the shorter form.
Yes, he was. I think those were the first plays that he wrote. I think Happy Journey to Trenton and Camden was one of his early ones and very successful. And The Long Christmas Dinner is probably one of his best-known plays. But there are others as well. But then... toward the end of his life, very, very near the end of his life, he wrote two cycles of plays. One was called The Seven Deadly Sins. Those he completed, and some of them are wonderful. And then he started writing The Seven Ages of Man. The first one he wrote, of course, was Infancy. The next one he wrote was Childhood.
Oh, those were from 1962.
And we're doing two of the, we're doing both of those. Mm-hmm. He never got further than that, really. He died not long after that. Both those plays were produced, and I think he saw them produced, which is kind of wonderful. Mm-hmm. So when we decided we wanted to do some one acts by Thornton Wilder, the question was, how are we going to put them together? You know, we only had two from the last cycle. It seemed sensible to do Happy Journey and Long Christmas Dinner, since they're two of the best one acts ever that he wrote. And they did seem to go together with Infancy and Childhood. It's really about human beings in families growing up and interacting. And I came up with a phrase that sort of fits, I think, all four of them. And that is, being human is hard.
So were there more that were being considered by the artistic team to bring
we
it down?
We read
to these
a
four?
Lot of one acts, mm-hmm. and these were the four that we picked because of the subject matter, because we felt they were well written, and we felt that ultimately they did go together. They worked together.
Wilder was lifelong friends with Gertrude Stein and was apparently a mentor to Edward Albee. And he was called an experimenter in his theatrical works. In what way are these different or experimental for theater?
Well, first of all, Happy Journey is the first play that he wrote in which he absolutely, categorically specified there was to be no scenery. None. And that was unusual.
Sure.
There's also a character in that one act who is a stage manager. Later on, he was going to do that in Our Town, which became one of his most famous plays.
Sure, Pulitzer Prize for that.
Yeah, but this was the beginning of that kind of thing. He was just extraordinary in that regard. He basically wanted to say something, and he wanted to say it with the actors and with his play.
And without being distracted by
exactly
anything else
so.
On the stage.
So exactly
the words
so.
Were paramount.
Right. And he succeeded, in my opinion. I think it's wonderful. The other playwright that he reminds me of, in a funny kind of way, is Samuel Beckett. Because both of them are sort of essential. They don't write long, long, long speeches that go nowhere. If they write a speech, it's got something to say, and you better figure out what that is. Otherwise, you're in big trouble. Mm.
I pulled a quote from The Times about the happy journey to Trenton and Camden. The Times wrote, quote, "If God were to dabble in anthropology and the recording angels to write with wry humor and infinite tolerance of human folly, this is how the holy books would read."
Isn't that wonderful?
That's a wonderful quote.
It is.
That sounds like it's a wonderful evening of theater with this one play in particular, this
we
one
certainly
short play.
Hope so. Whatever deficiency there is not, of course, anything to do with Wilder. But it's going well. I have a terrific cast, and I love working on the plays. It's hard. It's very difficult mm-hmm. to do them. Because so much does depend on the actors, on bringing the script and the actors together.
And the actors are appearing in more than one of the plays, is that correct? Are they interchanging
yes.
roles?
Yes. Two of them appear in three of the four. There are seven actors altogether, including one very talented young woman who's a recent grad from Cal. Two of them have three plays each. The others appear in all four. So
tell us what it's like working and directing someone who is obviously very close to you. your son,
my son,
Soren Oliver, is being directed by his mom
yes.
in one of these plays.
Not for the first time.
Okay.
Soren and I have worked together a number of times. And when I read Infancy for the first time, I just felt that... The policeman, the Keystone Cop, was a role for him, and he agreed. And so he's having fun doing it, and I'm having fun watching him do it.
Can you be a little bit harder on him than the other actors? Or
No, it's just different, you know. trying to be terribly professional about the whole thing.
But he never shouts out, "Oh, Mom!"
No, he does. He does call me up sometimes after rehearsal, and we have long conversations.
That's
But no, we try and keep it as professional as possible.
Very good. Getting back to Thornton Wilder, apparently he has some ties that I didn't know, since I'm fairly new to the Bay Area, since 2002. He has some very close ties to the Bay Area.
He certainly does.
Went to Creekside Middle School in Berkeley and graduated from Berkeley High.
Yes, he did. He also went briefly to a school called Emerson, which is about a block away from my house where I live now and where my children all went. Hmm. The school has been, there's a new building. It doesn't look the way it did when he went to school there. But yes, when I found out about that, I was doing the stage manager in our town at the Rep, and I discovered that the family had lived in two houses very near in our neighborhood. One was at the corner of Parker and College. I have no idea whether that building still stands or not. I suspect it doesn't. And the other was on another nearby street. And I made a point of walking around and looking at all of them.
Very nice. That was fun.
Yeah, he was remarkable. His father was a consul for the United States government in Hong Kong. And originally, when he got that appointment, the whole family went with him to Hong Kong, because they thought they would all be there together, you know, and they thought it would be very good for the children. It didn't work out. I think primarily because they didn't feel that they could get the schooling for the kids that they needed. So the family, the mother and the children, came back to Berkeley. The father stayed there until he had completed his term as consul. And the family lived in Berkeley, went to the First Congregational Church. As I said, Emerson School, and as you said, he did indeed graduate from Berkeley High. One of my favorite stories, I can't resist this one. He loved music. All his life he loved music, and his family was very musical. They discovered that St. Mark's Parish, Episcopal Church, which happens to be my parish, had a new organ, and they needed somebody to pump the organ. There was a job available. So Thornton Wilder applied for the job. He was a kid at that point. He wasn't very old, and got the job. So he would go to church school at the First Congregational Church, and then he would leave, and he would book across the street to St. Mark's, which is not very far away, a block maybe, and put on whatever he had to put on, pump the organ.
That's great.
Yeah.
Yeah. You mentioned that the concluding of the four plays is The Long Christmas Dinner,
right,
which is from 1931. It's a work that I'm not familiar with. I'm looking forward to get to know not only by seeing it, but by reading it. Wilder wrote of The Long Christmas Dinner, "Of all my plays, it is the one that has found the widest variety of receptions. At some performances, it has been played to constant laughter. Some listeners are deeply moved and shaken by it." I'm not familiar. Could you maybe get us into that play in particular, The Long Christmas Dinner? What is that all about?
The Long Christmas Dinner is exactly that. It tells you the story of a family who have one Christmas dinner after another for 90 years, and it's a one act.
Wow.
So the transitions come rapidly, and trying to mark them and help people experience them is not easy.
But I understand the time frame.
Exactly.
Involved. Sure.
Yeah. It's a family that's living on the near St. Louis, I think, probably. That's what we assume. Very near the Mississippi River. And they've not been there very long. And life goes on, and they get richer and more established. And some of the characters decide they can't stand it anymore, and they leave, and others stay. People die. People are born. People grow up, you know. All in the space of about 35 minutes.
The Long Christmas Dinner from 1931, along with The Happy Journey to Trenton and Camden, 1931. And then two plays from 1962, Childhood and Infancy. The production is called Wilder Times, four short plays of Thornton Wilder that have never been performed on stage together before. Barbara Oliver is director. Thanks so much for taking some time today with us.
I thoroughly enjoyed it. Thank you.
The show opens tonight, the 8th of November, and it runs through December 7th.
10th, I think.
December 9th, according to the press release here. Tuesdays at 7, Wednesday through Saturday 8, some matinees on Sunday afternoons as well. The performances take place at the Aurora Theater. Aurora Theater with an RE.org is the website. There are some discount tickets for half-off tickets, actually, for students and under 30 crowds. Group discounts available. Visit their website, auroratheater.org. Barbara, again, what a pleasure talking with you.
My pleasure entirely.
As Barbara was leaving the studio, she shared with me a brief quote of Thornton Wilder, which I think are words of wisdom for the ages. We must take ourselves as we find ourselves, always hoping for some improvement, but accepting the basic cast of the die. Thank you for that, Barbara. Broadway royalty now on Open Air. My next guest is the only person to win Tony Awards in the same categories, category of Best Choreography and Best Direction of a Musical in consecutive years, and the first to win in four different categories. To date, he has won 9 Tony Awards, and I say to date because now, even as a septuagenarian, he's got another award or two down the road, I think, showing no signs of slowing down. Fortunately, he has a very young-sounding name. Tommy Toon, welcome to Open Air.
Thank you. I'm a septuagenarian. You're the first person that's called me that. I like it.
Oh, I'm glad you like
Who
it.
Who wants to marry a septuagenarian? That's a line from some Broadway show. Little Abner.
Has to be a show. Oh, Little Abner, okay.
Yeah.
Well, you'll be performing here in San Francisco at the Fairmont's Venetian Room on Sunday, November 11th, a 5 p.m. show entitled Taps, Tunes, and Tall Tales,
yeah.
A special one-performance-only appearance. Now,
it's a world premiere, actually. It's the first time I'll be performing it. It's a brand-new show. I'm going to be doing it all over the country, and I'm starting at the Venetian Room.
Nice. It's a very descriptive title, but can you tell us more about the show? Is this entirely your concept?
Yeah, it is. It's my life. This is my 50th year in show business, so I thought, well, attention must be paid. I have to examine myself and see where I'm at and see what I've accomplished. And boy, it's a lot to fit into an hour show, but I hopscotched through it, and I used a lot of really good music. I'm using Cole Porter and the Gershwins and Carole King, Green Day, Kurt Vile.
You're covering the bases, boy.
Burt Bacharach, Irving Berlin, who else? Lerner and Lowe, Lieber and Stoller. But they all of these songs I put together, and they help chart my arc from starting in Texas and coming up here and my arrival in New York, and we recreate my first audition and stuff like that. It's a good show. I'm very proud of it.
What sort of musical accompaniment is going to be involved?
One piano. This is a real concert. Michael Biaggi at the piano. He has been my music director for 37 of my 50 years in show business. He's from your area, I think.
Wow, okay. Well, check him out. So tell me, what are the challenges of keeping up your body for dancing at your age? I mean, I'm 49, and I feel the creaks of years of running and biking and tennis now. 50 years or so of tap is pretty hard on the body, isn't it?
I started when I was 5 dancing, and I really wanted to be a ballet dancer, and then I just kept growing, and after about 13. I was a really good ballet dancer until about 13, and then I just kept getting taller and taller because I'm like 6'6" and a half now. And so I had to change careers. And so I moved into more stage dancing and tap dancing. And I don't know, it's a constant process. It's yoga and be careful with the diet and dance training, you know, and weight training. And you just... you learn how to, you know, pull yourself together and get on with it.
I imagine a lot of stretching involved with the yoga.
Yeah, stretching and strength training and diet, of course, is so important. But they're always changing their minds on what's good for us to eat. But I keep trying to keep up with the best of what everyone has to suggest. And I don't know, there's also a spirit, you know, your spirit helps a lot too. And I've been very, very lucky. I haven't had too many injuries. Sometimes, you know, you hurt yourself and you break something, you miss a season just like any athlete would. But I don't know, I'm grateful that I can still do it.
Well, 50 years in show business, you must have a slew of stories to share, and I'm sure part of that's one of the involved in the show. Can you maybe share
the tall tales part of the show?
Well, share with us a favorite story.
Well, no, you have to come see the show.
Well, one of the other stories, then.
I have to say that through it all, I've had a guiding light, and that is Carol Channing. I met her when I was 17. She came down to Dallas to do a show.
San Francisco girl.
And yeah. And I think I heard that she's going to come to see it, the performance at the Venetian Room.
Well, that would be great.
She's planning it. It was supposed to be a surprise, but I found out. But she has always been right there for me. And any difficult thing I would have to decide upon, any decision, difficult decision, I would check in with Carol, and she was infallible. She was just, she helped me so much and continues.
She's really something.
She's really, you know, Liz Smith calls her a closet intellectual because she plays dumb, but she's so intelligent. And she's quite a force of nature. I just love her. She's like my godmother.
In your 1997 memoir, which was called Footnotes, you wrote about what drives you as a performer, choreographer, director. Now, 15 years after that publication, does all that still apply? Do we need to supplement that memoir somewhere?
Well, I'm going to have to write another one. That was just, I don't know how old I was when I wrote that, but I've changed my mind on a lot of the things that I wrote in that book, like you do. And, yeah, I have plenty. I've lived a lot more, so I'm going to have to write another one.
Well, you also offered stories about being openly gay in the world of theater. Now, even though that was in 1997 when you wrote the book, did you have any reservations about being out to the world in print that way?
I just never thought it was such a big deal. I think that perhaps if you're in government or something, it is a big deal, but I don't define myself as a gay entertainer. I define myself as an entertainer. And I sing and I dance and I act and I direct and I choreograph and I make shows and I write and I paint. And one of the things I am is gay. But that does not inform my whole life. My whole life, that just happens to be the card that I was dealt.
I'm with you on that same page, so yeah, I quite understand that.
So it was not a big deal. I guess if it had been a big deal, maybe I wouldn't have written about it in an open way. But this is a book that I wrote to maybe help people with their lives, and if I can illuminate how it's not such a big deal. That, you know, what's the difference between that being that or being Jewish or being black or why? You know, there's so much room in life for all different kinds of people. And if you go around with an open heart and you want to do good in the world, what does it matter?
That's what it's all about, isn't it?
Well, to me.
I'm sure it will help some young folks, especially coming out, not knowing who to talk to.
I've gotten some wonderful letters back from people that, you know, thanked me for being so frank and kind of, you know, not making such a big deal of it. It's really not a curse. It's just the way the cookie crumbles.
Sure. Now, you'll be doing the same show in the next couple of weeks at Feinstein's in New York.
Yeah.
And I guess you mentioned it's going to be national. But beyond this show, what else are you working on now? Or is it maybe time to spend more time in the gallery painting in Chelsea that you manage? Featuring your own works, by the way, that gallery.
I do paint a lot. But I'm getting ready to make my operatic debut with the Houston Grand Opera. The Houston Grand Opera is doing a production directed by Francesca Zambello of Showboat, this American classic musical that really is almost operatic in its scope. And I'm playing Captain Andy, the captain of this showboat, so I'm still playing a showman.
Well, fantastic.
And my first dad role.
All right.
That's significant.
Well, Tommy Tomb tapping atop Knob Hill Sunday, November 11th, all 6'6" of him. A great way to spend a Sunday afternoon. Check out BayAreaCabaret.org for details for this one performance only engagement. Tommy, thanks so much for taking some time today.
My pleasure. I'll see you soon.
Safe travel.
Bye.
Tommy Tune tapping and singing, and I've got those feeling too good blues today. Instead of tap shoes, be there with bells on if you're interested in that Venetian Room performance this Sunday at 5. Information at Venetian.com. Well, that about concludes things for Open Air this week. I do have one last ticket giveaway for you for the Bay Area Rainbow Symphony. Moore Copeland on the program. Quiet City, Jamie Hopps featured on trumpet, Fred Fox on English horn. Quiet City of Copeland, Beethoven's Fifth Symphony, Bruch Concerto for Clarinet and Viola with Jody Levitz on viola and Susan Barnes clarinet. Tickets, I've got three pair or so, 415-841-4134 here in the studio, 841-4134. The concert is this Saturday at Calvary Presbyterian Church, Saturday, November 10th, 8 p.m. performance at Calvary, the Bay Area Rainbow Symphony. bars-sf.org, or if you'd like a pair of tickets, give me a call right now, 841-4134. Lots going on in the Bay Area, of course. Plus, here on KLW, invite you to join me Monday evening for the next couple episodes of Explorations in Music. As we conclude over these next 2 weeks, our exploration of the music of Franz Schubert with the always entertaining Robert Greenberg and the Alexander String Quartet. That's Monday at 9 o'clock. Monday at 9, and on the 19th of November, we'll have a special celebration for the life and times of longtime announcer here, Alan Farley. That'll be at the Green Room from 5 to 8 p.m. Monday the 19th. Great music, great food. If you're interested in that, details are at our website, kalw.org. We'll also rebroadcast a special appearance that Alan had with Chloe Veltman on Voice Box. That'll be on Friday the 15th of November at 10 o'clock for Voice Box, where Alan talks about the songs of 1941, a recording that was made in celebration of this station's 70th birthday. That's Voice Box a week from this Friday. I'm David LaTulipe. Thanks for tuning in to Open Air. If you've got suggestions for guests or some cultural events that you'd like to see mentioned, hear mentioned on the radio, drop me an email, david@kalw.org. An hour of news from the BBC is next here on KLW. It was recorded an hour earlier for broadcast at this time. We'll have headlines from Washington as part of that broadcast. This is KALW San Francisco, your local public radio station. And the time is 2 o'clock.